And I suppose I should quasi-officially welcome you on behalf of the Association for Mormon Letters, which is sponsoring this session. I'll quickly introduce the panelists. I'm Bruce Jorgensen, formerly president of the Association of Mormon Letters, and an occasional writer, but not very frequent publisher of short stories. Our panelists include Pauline Mortensen, who has published a book of stories back before the world turned nasty, some of which earlier appeared in places like BYU Studies, South Dakota Review, Cimarron Review, Phoebe, and Hayden's Ferry Review. Helen Walker Jones, who has published stories in Harper's, Florida Review, Cimarron Review, Nebraska Review, Cheriton Review. I could go on. That was about half of them. And Dialogue, Sunstone, Utah Holiday, etc. Helen has sworn off short stories for a while, at least, to try to write a novel, about 3 years of that. Daryl Spencer has also published short stories quite widely and has published a book, A Woman Packing a Pistol, a number of copies of which were ordered by West Point. One suspects that it was thought to be a training manual of sorts. So that book may soon be out of print if the if the Army gets hold of it. Daryl has also been working on a novel lately, but also continues to write and publish short stories quite frequently. I'll begin with some general comments, and then we'll see who goes first after that. We'll all try to take somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes, and that should allow some time for discussion with you. And it might be that since there are so few people in the audience, that if you want to ask a question, you could come up to the mic yourself and ask it. They do want all questions to be read into the microphone. One of the first things that I felt like doing with the panel title we were given, about which I didn't have a chance to talk with Susan Howe, was to question the question, what is the short story? It looks suspiciously like a question about essence or ontology. What is the short story? And I wonder about the also, as if there were some sort of Platonic form that we can call the short story instead of just all those thousands and thousands of stories out there, published and unpublished. Maybe a better question would have been, how do short stories go? Or what do short stories do, especially when they get some reader alone in a dimly lit corner? I thought I would use a few quotes and anecdotes. This is one of my favorites from Flannery O'Connor. She says, everybody thinks he knows what a story is, but if you ask a beginning student to write a story, you're liable to get almost anything, a reminiscence, an episode, an opinion, an anecdote, anything under the sun, but a story. A story, she says, is a complete dramatic action. It's very Aristotelian of her. Elsewhere, she says something roughly similar. I find that most people know what a story is until they sit down to write one. Then they find themselves writing a sketch with an essay woven through it, or an essay with a sketch woven through it, or an editorial with a character in it, or a case history with a moral, or some other mongrel thing. I like those because they tally with my own experience as a teacher of those beginning writers that she's talking about. From my own classroom experience, I would say that to some students, a fair number of them, a story is something that begins with somebody waking up in the morning and putting his or her foot on the cold floor, and then we go on from there. Or a story sometimes is something in which somebody stops and remembers and thinks. Maybe on a mountaintop. I remember one in which a character got himself high on a mountaintop somewhere on the U.S.-Canadian border to think about the girl that he'd been going with, who'd gotten pregnant, but he didn't think it was his, although it could be, and he was thinking what a slut she was, and he was also worrying about her one of her other boyfriends who was driving around in his car with a baseball bat in the trunk, waiting for this guy who is up on top of the mountain. But the story was this guy up there on the mountain thinking about all this, and I wrote back to this student. I said, "You've got an Elmore Leonard novel here. Instead, you've got it all inside this guy's head." Well, anyway, a story is something which somebody stops and remembers and thinks about a situation or a problem, but nothing happens. One of the things I do in class often, probably depressingly often in the eyes of my students, is to ask them to write something I call a story idea. I stole this notion from Frank O'Connor, the Irish short story writer who taught in America back in the 50s and I guess into the early 60s. O'Connor said that he used to make his students refrain from writing stories for a number of weeks, and all he would allow them to do would be to write down little four-line summaries of the action of a story. Five, if they must be garrulous, he said. Anything more than the bare bones of the action was not subject but treatment. And I persist in having my students try that, though I know it's not the only way to write a story. But it is a way to see if one does have a complete action, to echo Flannery O'Connor's phrase again. And it's very hard for them to write such a thing down. What they often give you is the summary of a situation, something like this. A 38-year-old woman with six children wakes up one morning to discover that her husband has left her for his pretty secretary. She must face, etc. And they don't tell me what she does. I always write back, "Well, okay, what does she do? And what happens next?" So they'll give me situation. Depressingly often, they will give me things that run something like this. A lonely and sad old man takes a walk in the park, and there he meets a crippled child. The two learn from one another about life. Okay, story. A short story is something in which somebody learns something from his opposite number. Or they'll give me quite often things that I call teasers. They're like those 30-second clips that precede the titles on TV programs. Written down, they will run something like this, and I'm making this one up, and the others were sort of synthetic from many years of trying this assignment. But this one is not originally mine, and not one that my students have ever given me. They'll go something like this: "I walked into the telephone booth and dropped the coin in the slot and started dialing when I realized there was a gorilla staring at me through the glass of the side of the booth, ... In other words, situation again, but not story. In other words, what I'm saying is that my experience as a teacher does tend to confirm some of the things that O'Connor said, and I'm sure that was based on her experience going to writing workshops and so forth, being the visiting writer at this or that workshop. I find readers sometimes are perplexed also. A couple of months ago, I went down to Panguitch, the hometown of Don Marshall, a short story writer, to discuss the anthology Greening Wheat under the auspices of what's called the Book Group. I think it's funded by the Utah Endowment for the Humanities. And one of the responses I remember from one person in the audience, an audience mainly composed of middle-aged women and a few high school students who were taking this series for credit of some sort. One woman said, "Well, I read some of those stories, and there was just nothing in them for me. I couldn't see any point. I didn't get any message. And so out there, generally in the land, it seems to me, that despite all of one's efforts in the classroom, and I do teach a short story class fairly frequently, despite all of one's efforts in the classroom, there is still a lack of the comprehension. So the question is a real one, although I don't know whether what is the short story is the way to formulate it. That woman's reaction to the stories in Greening Wheat might say something about the difficulty that a Mormon writer of serious short fiction faces with the Mormon audience at large. They may simply not know how to read what we try to write, or maybe we're not writing well enough. But her reaction reminded me of the early reviews of Dubliners, which I wasn't able to get my hands on and consult, but I remember a general impression of some of those early reviews of Joyce's Dubliners. The complaint that these stories have no point to them, they have no shape, they are mere sketches, mere anecdotes, and so forth. And it took us a long time to learn to read Joyce. And maybe he doesn't write short stories, maybe it's something else. One last quote, and then I'll just ask for who wants to be first. We didn't decide that. I've admired for many years the stories of André Dubuis, who I think is one of America's finest realistic short story writers. In interviews in 1981 and 1984, Dubuis said something to this effect. He said, "Our lives are not novels. They're a series of short stories." And then he went on to explain what he meant by that. I run into you one day and say, "Hi, how you doing?" And you tell me a little story. And maybe a month or two later, I run into you again and say, "Hi, how's it going?" And you tell me another little story. And his emphasis is on the fact that brief narrative, I think there are two points to be made out of this, brief narrative is very, very common in our interactions with one another. And also, I think, he's stressing discontinuity. We very seldom grasp our lives as some single, large, coherent action that you might call a novel, whereas we can grasp our lives in terms of the smaller actions that are like short stories. One question that would occur with that, though, is, well, André, I'd a lot rather read the stories you write than the stories I and my acquaintances tell one another when we run into one another. Somehow, those aren't really yet full-fledged short stories. Well, all the other panel members here are much more practiced at writing and finishing and publishing short stories than I am, so I want to hear them talk about this. From whatever angle they choose. Who wants to be first? Okay. We'll hear from Helen Jones.
Definitely the only way to do it. Then you can sit and enjoy the rest of it. I thought it was interesting that Bruce mentioned the method he used in his classes of outlining stories, because yesterday I just happened to read a quote by Graham Greene where he said that as a beginning writer, he would just write these huge volumes of preparatory stuff before he actually wrote his novel, and that the process of writing the novel was pruning. That's all it was. And in his later years, all he did was write an outline, and then the revision process was filling it in. So maybe that's what it takes, Bruce, I guess. Even though I'm really a short story writer, I have just completed a novel at the behest of my agent, who insisted on telling me that no one ever got rich writing short stories, which I firmly believe. And so I did spend about 2 years writing this, and during that time I did not allow myself to read short stories, even though they are my preferred recreational reading. I've never been much of a novel reader, except the classics, maybe. I found that during the time that I was doing this, I stopped enjoying reading altogether because I was so analytical about what I was doing. I, I was reading simply to capture the rhythm and the cadence of the language, and for technical advice is what I was looking for in the pages of these novels. I wasn't reading for enjoyment or because I loved the style or I loved the story being told. And during this time, I found myself craving the succinctness and precision of short fiction. Because novels, I think, have more of a loose structure, a slower pace, necessarily. And around this time, I read an article by Ruth Prawer Jabala, who's a screenwriter. You may have seen Room with a View and Howard Zinn, some of those. She's really a wonderful screenwriter. She stated that her goal when she does her screenplays is to be able to capture the essence of a character in a 5 or 6 line speech. And I thought, really, that's what you have to do as a short story writer, too. And especially in this society, which is obsessed with 15-second sound bites, and that's kind of what we're trained to accept, and our attention spans aren't very long. And now that I actually have finished my novel and I've gone back to short stories, I find myself increasingly concerned with precision and exactness, particularly in the first lines of my story, because I think the first line is the invitation to the reader to continue on. And if you don't capture the reader with your first line, or at least your first paragraph, there will be no reader. The reader won't read it. We're all acquainted with famous first lines from novels. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, from Anna Karenina. And we all know those. They're really incredibly brilliant and express concepts illuminating the human condition in general. I don't think the first line of a short story is capable of really doing that, or at least if you used a line like that, it would probably be too weighty. I think it would kind of deter the reader from continuing. So I think its true nature really is to establish a rapport between the writer and the reader, to invite the reader to continue. One of my favorite quotes is from Thomas Mann, the famous German writer. I heard him speak when I was an undergraduate at the University of Utah. He was the commencement speaker 1 year, which still amazes me. I can't believe they could get anyone of that caliber, but must have paid him a lot of money. He said the difference between a novel and a short story is comparable to the difference between a mountain and a diamond. A mountain and a diamond. I think that's great. And while I love that metaphor, when I started thinking about this in more depth, I thought a short story is like a diamond with all of the facets that reveal themselves in different lights. But it's also like a pearl, because it starts with a bit of grit and then is coated in multiple layers, each of which increase its beauty and value. The bit of grit usually strikes the writer as an image, a phrase, a name, a title. Sometimes you just hear a person's name and you immediately think, oh, I've got to have a character name that. And the name itself reveals an entire person to you. I'm thinking of Daryl's story about Buzz Galter. That's one of the great names of all time. And I'm sure that when he got that name in mind, that a lot of the story kind of laid itself out for him.
Is that true, Daryl?
Yeah, okay. And when I was thinking about this idea, I glanced back at the first sentences of some of my own stories to see if I could remember what image or what little bit of grit prompted me to write the story itself. I do have one story called Doing the Foxtrot, which is about a 75-year-old woman. And it came to me one day when I was sitting in my mother's living room watching her undo one of those horrendous cardboard packets that has a Reader's Digest record in it. It was called Swing Time with the Big Bands, and I thought she was reading me off some of the names, these horrible names. I don't know how anybody in that generation could ridicule the Grateful Dead or the Rolling Stones after hearing some of these atrocious names for the swing bands. And out of the blue, I concocted a name for my own band, Ramon Zerke and his Yankee Doodle Dandies, and I wrote a story about it, and it was called Doing the Foxtrot. And this is the first sentence of the story. Myrtle Henwood lives upstairs from Orvin Meldrum, as do 27 other widows. Still, he chose her. And so, you know, it just kind of one idea leads to another. Another image that prompted me to write a story was the memory of a young woman who lived with my family when I was about 8 years old. She used to wash her feet every night in the bathroom sink. I really seriously don't think she'd ever had a bathtub and didn't know what it was for at first. But she was very scrupulously clean. She'd wash her feet in the sink every night and leave pumice grit on the black washcloths. And I can still remember coming in there and seeing that and wondering what it was until I watched her do it. Well, I wrote a story about this woman, and this was the first sentence. In the want ads these days, they're called nannies or au pairs. But in the Canadian farming town where I grew up, they were the daughters of immigrant beet field workers, and we called them hired girls. Another story that I wrote is about a woman who returns from a mental hospital, comes home to her family. They've taken her children away, but she does come back to her husband. And I got the idea for this from actually a friend of mine who was in this exact situation. Her husband was a very understanding man, and the therapist told him that when she began to act strangely, he should put her in a room, lock the door, and in this room she had about 50 pairs of socks. And what she had to do was fold all of the socks. That was her job, because she couldn't focus on any kind of work. It was too stressful for her, but she felt she was accomplishing nothing. So she would fold these socks very neatly, then he would come and get them in an hour, take them out, unfold them all, bring them back, and she did that over and over and over. And this is the first line of that story. Julia had come back from Okotoks the night before, and now she was in the backyard weeding the dahlias in her wedding gown, because it seemed to be the sort of thing people would expect of her. And it kind of goes on from that point. Now I'd like to read you some truly masterful bits of grit around which pearls have been formed. These are other people's stories, and I cannot imagine a reader not wanting to finish stories that begin this way. The first one is by a Chinese woman named Gish Jen, G-I-S-H-J-E-N, a wonderful writer. She's a Chinese-American. She's grown up here, but her parents are natives of China. To protect my sister Mona and me from the pains, or as they pronounced it, the pins of life, my parents did their fighting in Shanghai dialect, which we didn't understand. And when my father one day pitched a brass vase through the kitchen window, my mother told us he had done it by accident. That's the first line. This one is by a woman named Jessica Neely. For some reason or other, I find that I'm really more drawn to stories by women. Pauline's going to talk about feminism in the short story, so maybe it has something to do with that. I don't know. I just seem to be more drawn to them. It's not that I don't read men's stories, but they seem to be my favorites. This is the first sentence of this story. In the beginning of the summer, my mother memorized the role of Lady Macbeth 4 mornings a week and worked the late shift in geriatrics. Isn't that a great opening? I mean, I was dying to read that story as soon as I read that line. Here's another one by Edith Milton. My father was shot down over Japan in 1944, about 3 days after I was born, and my mother gave me to his parents as a sort of consolation prize. This one is very short, but I do think it captures your interest immediately. Two people stood quarreling in the casket showing room. Great situation. In fact, you know, this might be interesting to... That's Carol Bly. Might be fun in a writing class to give this kind of an assignment, to give a first sentence and then have people finish it. And every story would be totally different. I've done that sometimes with my students, and it's incredible what they'll come up with. The last one is by John Updike. Though I was between marriages for several years, in a disarray that preoccupied me completely, other people continued to live and die. I like that. Anybody who's ever been divorced will know what he's talking about. And I really do think those are some of the finest opening sentences that I have ever read. I just think they're fabulous. I just kind of looked through some anthologies that I had and some old New Yorkers and things until I came up with some really great first sentences. It occurred to me that one of the problems of literally inviting the reader into the story is that sometimes the reader identifies too strongly with the speaker, and a lot of people assume that the narration is just a straightforward explication of the author's life. I just want to tell you a couple of funny things that have happened to me about this by people who really should know better, editors and readers who are pretty sophisticated. A few years ago, after one of my stories appeared in Harper's, I received a letter which was sent to the magazine and then forwarded to me from a wealthy Texan who assumed that I was the beautiful, wisecracking 30-year-old widow who narrates the story, and he proposed marriage to me on the basis of having read the story. And he told me that he had fallen in love with me after reading these lines. Once a devout Catholic, Mother recently converted to Mormonism and now keeps a snapshot of Ezra Taft Benson and Dwight D. Eisenhower on her nightstand. I think she fell for the handsome, short-haired missionaries with their Donny Osmond teeth and shiny blue 10-speed bikes. A celibate is always a challenge. So that got me a proposal of marriage, what can I say? I wrote that man a very nice letter and thanked him and assured him that I was happily married, the mother of teenagers on the backside of 40, and never, ever went around the house wearing a purple bath towel tucked under my armpits like the character in the story does. I also had a similar experience from an editor in Washington, D.C., who published one of my stories. The main character in this one, this is the first line of that story. She's wearing black pumps with cut-out toes, a black linen dress dipping just low enough to show a shadow of cleavage and pearls. To her, it's a uniform. By the way, I used a lot of semicolons in case you're wondering how that could be one sentence. Anyway, the editor really liked those lines, but there were other things about the story that he didn't particularly care for. And he wrote to me and he said, you know, I don't like this word, I don't like this word. Would you change these? So I'd look at him. If I agreed, I'd change it. I'd send it back to him. He'd say, well, now this changes the rest of the story. Now I don't like this, I don't like that. And we kept corresponding like this. They were just little quibbles. It was nothing major. We probably wrote back and forth to each other 15 or 20 times. And this took about 18 months. Finally, I thought, this is going nowhere. I'll never get this story published. I might as well start sending it to other people. And I finally wrote him a letter and told him that. And he said, oh, okay, I'll publish it. And so he did. And after the story came out, and I had the copy of it sitting there, I got a phone call, a long-distance call. And he said, hi, this is Richard Peabody. The name meant nothing to me. I had absolutely no idea who Richard Peabody was. I couldn't remember this. And just out of the blue, finally he said, well, do you like the story? Do you like the way it looks in print? And so I started racking my brain, finally remembered this is the guy I'd written all the letters to. And he said, I am tired of the East. I'm leaving. I'm moving out to Taos so I can be with other writers and, you know, kind of establish a community of friends out there. And he said, you know, Utah and New Mexico are pretty much in the same neighborhood. Typical Easterner's conception, I guess. He said, well, are you going to be passing through anytime soon? I said, no, I really don't plan on it. And finally, after our conversation kind of took the same form as our letters, a little bit here, a little bit there, it just kind of went on and neither of us knew what the other one was talking about. Finally, it came down to the point that he really wanted me to move down there and live with him. And this was the same thing. He had mistaken me for this 25-year-old blonde who wore sheer black stockings with little curly cues sneaking up the seams. And I said in the story, it looked as though somebody had doodled on her legs with India ink. I guess he really fell in love with this woman. And believe me, for somebody who's all my life has worn Coke bottle bottom glasses and had a weight problem, it's wonderful to know that men can fall in love with you long distances. It's one of the best perks of short story writing. I recently spoke with a man who told me he doesn't read fiction anymore because it always gives him the same sensation that he's looking at a stranger. I can't talk. He's looking at a stranger's family photographs. I thought that was really an interesting concept. And I decided that my aim, really, as a short story writer, is to make the reader feel at least as though he's one of the distant cousins by creating characters and details that will establish a sense of immediacy and kinship. And one of the ways that I hope to do that is by capturing the attention of the reader in the first sentence of the story. Thank you.
Pauline Mortensen says she will go next. That leaves you stuck, Daryl.
I'm going to need a couple helpers, and since Helen said she never got to hold up things in Sunday school, she's going to help me. And I'd like Susan Howe to help me about... I mean, you can come up and sit on the front. That would be most convenient. Yeah, and it'll be, you know, towards the end, so you can relax till then if you want. Okay, what is the short story? I know it's different from a novel, because people who write novels, don't take this personally, always seem to know where they are going. For one thing, they have the beginning on one side and the ending on the other, and all they have to do is fill in all that white space in the middle. And they can do it, too, because they are up to it. But people who write short stories, on the other hand, are sorry, fragmented individuals with many beginnings and many endings. The white spaces are lean indeed, and they must carve as if it were out of granite each perfect first and last line. And maybe we should change this to pumice or sandstone at this point, you know. In fact, if you were new to this quadrant of the galaxy and you wanted to ask directions to Temple Square, and the first person you asked was a short story writer, you'd never make it. You would need a longer narrative to sustain you. I know this is true. I know it for a fact. I know of at least three alien couples who asked Levi Peterson the way to Temple Square, and they're still wandering around in the desert somewhere south of Moab. Then there was that Levite starship which passed through Provo last September. They asked Daryl Spencer the way to Temple Square and were never heard from again. This problem with short story writers has been going on for some time, and it's more than a regional problem. I'm sure a short story writer is what Plato had in mind when he banished the poets from heaven. Not to be confused with the money changers Christ kicked out of the temple, that would be your novelist. At any rate, the short story writer has come down to us now at the end of the 20th century with a new form of devilment, and that devilment is pluralism. Much has been said of pluralism in the sanctioned sense, from Brigham Young to Roland Barthes. When it comes to sanctioning pluralism, Brigham Young and Roland Barthes are in full agreement. They are both for it. But when it comes to signifieds, they part company, and did on many occasions. In fact, Brother Roland would say, if he were here today, in the ideal text, the networks are many and interact without any one of them being able to surpass the rest. The ideal text is a galaxy of signifiers, not a structure of signifieds, but a text with many entrances and no one authoritative door. Now we're talking pluralism. That's pluralism with a capital P, and that rhymes with T, and that stands for trouble. It's trouble because the more plural the text, the less it is written, and that's double trouble if you're a creative writing teacher trying to convince your student, who happens to be up on his postmodern theory, that his story still needs work. Literature is a cacography, he says, and then he explains to you what that means. Cacography is bad handwriting, he says. It is a figurative expression, which means I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to account for my text or anything else that I have said. It just is. Let it be. Which leaves you tapping your foot in a literary quandary, wondering just what will they throw at you next. It's trouble for other reasons as well, because, as well, Barthes was speaking of our reading of a single text, but feminists have picked up on this idea of pluralism and twisted it around to suit themselves. And what they did with it should never, ever be mentioned in public, but I will mention it just this once. Feminists like this idea of many doors. They don't like getting trapped inside and being objectified in the text. They want to write their own text with themselves as heroes, not heroines. Can you imagine that? They want to save themselves. When it comes right down to it, what they really want to do is change history, change the way everything has been recorded and perceived from the beginning of whenever. They don't know when to leave well enough alone. We're lucky to have gotten this far without blowing everything to pieces, and that's with men in charge. Can you imagine what a woman would do to it? But that's another story. The problem with feminist writing is that it just came along too late, about the time we articulated the difference between the signifier and the signified and discovered that all literary texts are cacographies, intentional obscurities. Along came the women with their fancy handwriting and started writing well and making sense. And other marginalized positions began asserting themselves, battling it out for the mainstream, trying to say something without saying anything. Quite a balancing act, a Ringling Brothers three-ring circus. What the feminists said was, yes, we like the idea of pluralism. We like the idea of looseness at closure. That way no one closes us inside ever again. And yes, we like the idea of multiplicity. Let us hear the voices of community instead of one, the one and only tragic hero. For if the tragic hero is male, the prize is always a woman. Sometimes money, maybe a chalice or two. And if the tragic hero is a female, she is doomed to fail. If she struggles to break free of the cage, as in Kate Chopin's The Awakening, her tragic flaw is the fact that she struggled. So let's get rid of that idea, the struggle of the lone protagonist. Let us hear the music of many voices. In fact, let us create a multivocal text, and let us put it in the big top, a novel. That's what feminists did with it. They took the idea of one glorious text, distributed it like cheese to impoverished voices. And now what you have is a lot of rabble running around in collections trying to say something. This voice answering that, that voice echoing this. First thing you know, the gates of the canon will open up, and there will go Grace Paley, Ellen Gilchrist, Catherine Ann Porter, with all those connected short stories pretending to be a novel. It could happen, because now the short story writer who has had her close encounters of the Derrida kind can practice her pluralism beyond the sanctioned confines of the marriage of good and evil, of truth and fiction, of characterization and plot. She can practice such pluralism because Derrida and his others have deconstructed all those innocently paired hierarchies and left us all standing around trying to match our shoes and our gloves, our hands with our feet, our ears with our elbows. Nothing seems to fit just right anymore. The whole world's gone to hell in a handbasket. This story has no ending. That story has no plot. Story C is just too feminist. Story C isn't feminist enough. Story C would have been a story if it had just been written about the man. All those marginalized texts, don't they know there is nothing left to be said? And black writers are just as bad, and Indian writers, don't get me started. Did I mention Louise Erdrich, Maxine Hong Kingston, Tony K. Bambara? They all twist pluralism around to their own ends. Nothing matches up anymore, left and right, right and wrong, us and them. The hour is nigh, and the short story writer is the most mismatched bride person of the lot. And I don't even want to think about those 10 virgins without any oil in their lamps. It's just too much. So what we have in contemporary fiction are two strains of pluralism. This hits us especially hard when it comes to the short story, because pluralism is related to the silences in a story, the parts which are not written. In other words, when it comes to silences, a short story is full of it. In the Barthesian text, the reader must rewrite the text as he reads it in order to fill in the silences. And where does the reader get the raw material to write the text he is reading? But from his own cultural script, a script feminists see as politically, socially, and intellectually authored from the white male point of view. Without a cultural or theoretical script behind a text to help readers fill in the silences, the fictional text must break silences in order to be read at all. This limits its pluralistic potential in the way Barth defines it. Rather than multivocal texts which resist being read, feminist texts tend to break silences and insist on being read. According to the Barthesian position, feminist texts are univocal and political and seem to have a lot of old axes to grind. But according to the feminist position, all texts are political, including the avant-garde, which hopes to silence a myriad of literary texts being born late into the canon, but who are learning to speak nevertheless. So here we are, on page 6, without a thesis, and only 5 more minutes to kill. Let me put this another way. When I sit down to write my short story as a woman, as a Mormon, as a Western writer, and as a person from any other marginal group to which I belong, I am faced with two questions. How much should I put in? How much should I leave out? These questions have got to be easier for the novelist. You just put everything in. We are probably all familiar with the naive Mormon text, which tries to explain too much, because the writer is sure no one is going to be able to understand the strange way we live. It's a dilemma, but the naive Mormon writer is right. It can't be done. It can't be read unless she writes it in or limits her audience or pretends she's not a Mormon and makes up stuff she doesn't understand or care about. It's been my experience that writing stuff you don't care about only works when you're getting paid for it. Working at WordPerfect or something. I don't know. At any rate, the question is how to cope with the problem of pluralism, our struggle towards it, our struggle against it. I think they should make a pill for this. I'd buy it. But since they don't, I'll put the question yet another way. How much pluralism can a text take before it flies apart at the seams into chaos? If I am the only person who can read my text, is it still literary? Is that what Barth proposes in his flight from the univocal text, the sound of 1,000 voices on the Starship Enterprise amplified to a cacophonous roar, a roar that only Data can hear with his positronic brain? And is that what Derrida means by the deconstructive act, that the ultimate condition is to blast the text to pieces, then sit around looking at so much dust? I hardly think so. But I think it's what we hear. The metaphors are theirs to be sure, deconstruction and writing degree zero, metaphors which key into our subversive writer selves so that we shut out the parts where Derrida talks about reconstruction, or where Barth goes on for 200 pages to elaborate a merely multivocal text, something in the bad handwriting of Balzac. I guess what I am saying is, it's not that I disagree with Derrida and Barth per se, but the myth of Derrida and Barth, a myth created by their strategic sense of metaphor. That is, in order to get our attention, someone has been lighting fuses to see just how high we will jump. And according to my estimation, we have been jumping pretty high. Even with all those lead weights in our bellies, we have been so concerned about the rhetoric of deconstruction that we have forgotten about the rhetoric of reconstruction. Not that the idea ever really disappeared or was nullified by some cosmic theory. It has always been there, but it has been run over by a train, sort of flattened out on the ground, waiting for the receding sound of metal wheels before it can get back up. It has always been there, inherent in every lifting of the pen, the reconstructive act poised to rewrite the world. Don't get me wrong. I'm not affirming anything here but the pure and not so pure act of making. Whether you choose to make chocolate chip cookies or mud pies, that is your business. The point is that there are two impulses in the literary act, and this is especially true of the short story act. One is the impulse to take the world apart, and the other one is to put it back together. Remake it in your own image, perhaps, but make it nevertheless. What I offer, then, is a shifting of the metaphor. Instead of writing to rend the perceived cultural script, what we actually do is write to render it, not in the sense that someone renders a likeness, but in the pioneer sense of rendering meat, where you melt away the fat and what you have left over is something you can relate to, like dinner. Only this is a yuppie postmodern dinner, of course, where you taste a little bit of all the exotic fare, but when you're done, there's still plenty of food left over on your plate. To render, to make, to do, to perform, to furnish, to provide, to pay back. The list goes on. In fact, if you compare the possibilities for rend versus render, an unabridged dictionary would offer you about an inch of definition for rend, whereas render goes on for half a column, just to show you where the true possibilities for fiction are. In fact, if you were to chart this thing out on an XY chart and draw perfect, it might very well resemble a parabolic curve with the absolute univocal text at one end and the absolute cacophonous text at the other and all the literary variety in the bulging middle. But render is such an ugly word. You've got all that lard dripping all over the place. What we need is something softer and more refined. It's something that can rip the traditional text to shreds, cannibalize it, digest it, and then reinvent it. What we need is a metaphor that takes it apart and puts it back together. And now I need some helpers. What we need is the quilting effect. The quilting effect, one woman's view of the essence of postmodern short fiction. To begin with, the new short story is a non-traditional text, a remake, a hybrid, creating new possibilities out of old fictions. Parody and realism together at last, monolithic themes cut all the way down to the bias, then sewn back together against the grain. A remake, because on waking up one morning, I discovered that the old expectations of narrative wouldn't do, the hero in his place and me in mine. Gone are the lone stars, log cabins, little maids. Gone are the ring quilts, chain quilts, temple quilts. Gone are the pastels, flowers and percales. Gone are the thimble blisters, needle pricks and blood. Yes, it's different than it was. The simple 9-patch text has now escalated 21 patches. Instead of the one dominant effect, there is a galaxy of meaning in every patch. The text is multi-layered, juxtaposed, less blended. It is not like the blended text, which is stored in cedar chests, wrapped in cellophane, tucked in closets to save for generations. It is not like the blended text, which lies quietly across the bed when you lay it out to show your friends. It doesn't violate the room. On the other hand, what room can contain 32 dinosaurs, 2 mammoths, and a saber-toothed tiger? This text fits nowhere with complete ease, in the feminist camp, in the French camp, in the Mormon camp, or even the minimalist camp. It sleeps alone. This text is not as minimalist as it once was, because less is less, not more. More is bold, but since there is usually a ban on commentary text, the more text has a vested interest in details. Who could have predicted the effects of neon thread, the sharpness of sharp-toothed teeth, the pearlescence of Sarah's eye? Details discovered in process and sewn in, details pulled from many drawers, details which come bubbling up from who knows where, accidents of the thread. The postmodern woman's short story, then, is a multivalent text. Multivalence is also a Barthesian term, but it belonged to the electricians first. The multivalent text impedes meaning, resists interpretation, but as all electricians know, the current gets through nevertheless, or else there is no spark. The postmodern woman's short story is a multivocal text, then, because many voices can now speak, and we dare not ask, as we did of Faulkner, which is the one true voice, because many voices are now valid. Let us not say, then, when we are done, that this is a story about the mammoth when we are surrounded by reptiles. Or let us not say this is a story about thread when we are surrounded by reptiles. But first, let us say this is a story about reptiles. I see that now. Let's get on with it, then.
I probably can't follow that. Maybe I should just sit down. I guess I'm going to suggest that that stories need to be about threads. And so maybe that will initiate some kind of a discussion. I approach this by both taking the title seriously and trying to ignore the title of this particular meeting. And I'm teaching a short story class right now, and I'm using a book called Short Story Theory at the Crossroads by Lohhofer and Clary. There are two essays in there, one by Norman Friedman, and I thought I'd open just by reading a little bit from Friedman and then read you his definition of what a short story is. But we cannot either logically or empirically specify that the short story, because of its shortness, deals with epiphanic sorts of actions or with human experience at the boundary. Some of you will probably recognize that he's taking on certain theorists here. The first one, Rohrberger. The second one, probably O'Connor. Not Flannery, but is it Frank? Or with arrivals and our departures, or with romance more than realism. Nor can we specify that it deals with certain sorts of themes or that it embodies a certain sort of life vision. We cannot even specify, as our reader response critics are attempting to do, that it has a certain effect upon a reader because of its shortness. For it does, after all, share this with other forms as well. And then he gives us a very useful, and I'm sure that it's the only answer that you'll need today, definition of the short story. The short story is a short fictional narrative in prose. And that's his answer to the question, what is a short story? Not very helpful, not very useful, except if you want to be a scholar and if you want to try to define a genre, I guess. Austin Wright, in the same book, adds a little bit to this. He says, we will find no more traits more specific than those in Friedman's definition of the short story. Quote, a short fictional narrative in prose. And then he decides to add, I will restate here as a prose narrative dealing with a fictional world never much longer than Heart of Darkness. Narrative, he says, not drama. Fictional world making no claim to historical or factual truth, and then he provides a maximum length for it. He goes on to say that this is obviously, again, a superficial view. I guess all I'm trying to start out by saying is that I can't define the story for you, a short story. I'm not sure that anyone can. So what I thought I would do is just mention to you the two things that I think a short story ought to do. And I think it ought to do these things simply because it is a work of art, not because it's a short story. So there's no distinction made here, I think, between visual art, music, any kind of art at all. The first one, probably, as Bruce mentioned to me yesterday, many people have said this. I think my friend Francois Camoin says it best, at least for our contemporary times. Francois says that the short story does not assert anything. Therefore, it cannot be true or false. It cannot be moral or immoral, ethical or unethical. Chekhov, whom I'll probably quote badly here, but in writing a response to several people who had condemned him for writing stories, Chekhov said, you attack me, you condemn me for not, in my own stories, condemning horse thieves when I write about horse thieves. And Chekhov says, that's not my job. That's not the function or the purpose of short stories. It's not the purpose of art. We all know that horse stealing is wrong. We've known that for 100 years. My job is to give you the heart of the horse thief. I think Francois is saying the same thing. Second, and probably most important for me, and I'm not sure if I'm agreeing or disagreeing with what Pauline said, but the threads are what matter to me, and I think they matter in a very important way. I'm not going to, in any way at all, pretend to be somebody who understands Heidegger, but I'm going to use him a little bit here. I feel like, for me, every story must not use up its matter. That at some point, it must expose itself as a work of art in language. I think that the postmodernists failed in their attempt to do this, only because no one reads them. Their novels that they publish, that you buy them in a box, and when you open up the box, it says shuffle the pages and read it, shuffle them again and read it. Short stories in which the words fall off the pages. Short stories that are made up of tissues so that you read the story behind the story behind the story. Characters talking to authors. All the things that the postmodernists did would be successful, I guess, if people were to read them. But as I, class after class after class, I say, have you read Sukhanik? Have you read Fetterman? Have you read William Gass? And the answer is always no. But I think contemporary stories need to somehow accomplish what those people set out to do. And for me, that means that somehow they have to reveal the fact that they are written in language. Heidegger talks about the necessity for, in the essay called The Origin of the Work of Art. And he means by that the event of art, at least at one stage or at one level, I guess we could call it. He means the work of art as a as an active event, an ongoing event. And he says that it must not use up its matter. He provides the example of an axe or a hammer. He says when we make an axe, it uses up its stone. The stone disappears into its usefulness and it becomes a piece of equipment. And I think as long as we read short stories in order, as Bruce mentioned, to gain a meaning, in order to understand characters, in order to understand motivation, in order to determine a theme, in order to understand what it's like to be living in the world today, as long as we insist upon that, we are turning works of art into equipment. We are making them equipmental in a Heideggerian sense. A short quote from Heidegger. This is from The Origin of the Work of Art. To be sure, the sculptor uses stone just as the mason uses it in his own way, but he does not use it up. That happens in a certain way only when the work miscarries. To be sure, the painter also uses pigment, but in such a way that color is not used up, but rather only now comes to shine forth. To be sure, the poet also uses the word, not, however, like ordinary speakers and writers who have to use them up, but rather in such a way that the word only now becomes and remains truly a word. I think that in reference back to first to Bruce's first mention of Flannery O'Connor and I think his first or second passage, the short story has to become a mongrel thing, I think. In contemporary fiction, short story writers that I'm talking about, for me, Amy Hempel, Jane Ann Phillips, Grace Paley, Mary Robeson, Elizabeth Talent, Barry Hanna, and others. I'll use Roland Barthes. It seems to me that Barthes is right when he says, for I don't know how many years, we have insisted that language work scientifically, even in the arts. We have insisted that it teach us something, or that it show us something, or that it explain something to us. And Barthes argues that the work of art has to somehow return to literature that which it promised us in the beginning, which is the sovereignty of language. And I want to argue, I guess, that I think that's what contemporary fiction needs to do. And the answer to why, well, because it's language that we use to talk about everything. And language, by its very nature, distorts. And I think we need to avoid the illusion that it does not distort. We need to avoid the immersion. The transparency of language, and I think somehow the contemporary short story has to do that. Can't do it in a postmodern way, because those stories are not read, so it's got to find its own way to do that. I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't know how you do that. This is not really a seminar in that, so I think I'll just leave it at that. I tried a couple of years ago to write a short novel. Well, I guess it's been about 5 or 6 years ago, and a friend read it, and he said, you cannot do this to a reader. You cannot ask for this kind of intensity, line to line and word for word, for 200 or 300 or 400 pages. I'm not so sure. I know I appreciate the distinction that Pauline was making. I'm not so sure there is a distinction between the novel and the short story. I think the intensity that I've felt over the last 2 years, 2.5 years, writing a novel has been the same intensity of every sentence, every word somehow saying, I am language. Listen to me in that sense. That's about it. I can't define the story, but those are the things that I hope that the short story will achieve. Thanks.
That does leave us a goodly amount of time for questions and discussion. So please feel free. As I said, I think with the small numbers who are here, you could readily trot up to the microphone here and speak a question directly into it.
I attended LES High School more years ago than most of you have lived, and I had a young teacher, Waldo Osmond, the son of an Alfred Osmond, who I believe taught at BYU. And my introduction to literary criticism was a comment of his that in retrospect seems to me very sexist. He said a short story should be long enough to cover the subject and short enough to be interesting, like a woman's skirt, long enough to cover the subject and short enough to be interesting. That's a pretty risque kind of comment at an LDS high school. But it's about as workable a definition as I suppose any others we hear. My question is has to do with what happens to story. Isn't a short story writer a storyteller? And although I appreciate the emphasis on language, and everything comes back to that, of course, because words are the medium. Isn't there some value in telling a good story, short or long? And how can we get away from the referential values that language has? Irving Howe has said something like, literature can be autonomous, but not self-sufficient. And I think that tries to bridge the notion of the importance of the art in the writing and what that artful writing seems to say or want to say. Anyone on the panelists can respond to that, Bruce, if they would, including yourself.
Thank you, Bill.
Who would like to respond?
I don't know what. If you ask me about the quilt, and I wanted to tell you about the quilt that I created, I would want to tell you about the thread. I'd want to tell you about this button that I bought in 1972 at DI and saved for 25 years and finally put in this quilt. You know, I'd want to tell you about the thread. And I realize that it's made up of threads, and I would like to talk about all of that. But I would also like to talk about the reptile. You know, I mean, I think what you're saying about short stories, the telling, when you sit around with friends in a circle, I mean, you know, and they start, you know, they tell about their kids and they went to the store and you know they're not telling the truth because they exaggerate and this happened and I do the same thing when I tell these stories, but we like to present that idea of the illusion. And, you know, if you're crazy enough to believe it, then, you know, that's your problem. But that idea of transmitting the illusion, I think, is so basic. And, you know, I don't know if I'm answering your, you know, addressing your question exactly, but the sitting around the campfire in the traditional sense of storytelling, I think we, even though we recognize, or we could recognize that they are lying and exaggerating and we are doing the same thing, there's still some kind of point, I think, that your day was horrendous when the kid was hanging from the rafters in ZCMI or something, you know. And so, I don't know. I want to talk about the thread, but I also want to talk about the reptiles, is all my point.
I just wanted to say briefly, when I was an 18-year-old college freshman, I became acquainted with the writing of Robe Grier, the French writer. It was the first time I had ever understood that language was something other than a straightforward attempt to tell a story, except in poetry, and I guess I understood that. But as part of fiction, I became aware of just how intensely he packed the language into his stories, and yet I don't think he told a story, and I was kind of disturbed by that. It was kind of the trend at that time. I remember he had one short story about a painting. All he did was describe the painting. Nothing happened. It was very short, maybe 5 pages long. I thought it was really fascinating language, but basically overall boring because nothing happened in the story. I think what Daryl is saying is that the really, really good writers of this era, I mean, no one ever again will be satisfied with the kind of language that people were satisfied with maybe 30 or 40 years ago, except for, you know, the geniuses of who wrote before that time. But the generic writers today could not get away with that kind of pedestrian language. And I really think to be a really successful writer in this era, you have to combine the language with the story. And it may not be as overtly structured a story as maybe the traditional stories are, but I do think it has to tell a story, or it just isn't that interesting.
No, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't even try to respond to Bill Mulder's question, because I think it is a hard question that's raised whenever we try to talk about the kinds of things that Daryl has talked about, his sense that contemporary short stories need to somehow not use themselves up, not become equipment, and remind us that they're made in language. I've sat here trying to think if I could just quote an example, and I can't. Some days I'm good at this, at quoting. But it seems to me that maybe there is an area where Daryl and Bill might be saying almost the same thing. Because I think Bill did say something about telling a story well, a well-told story. And it's that sense that we have when we can say that story is well told as opposed to clumsily told. Both stories, of course, have to be told in language. There isn't anything else. Well, okay, cartoons, maybe a quilt even would tell a story. I didn't try to get the narrative, if there was one, of all means, quilt, you know, from panel to panel. But we're mostly talking about stories told in language and not otherwise. It seems to me that the well-told story delivers a kind of, well, I was going to say constant, but really maybe it isn't constant, maybe it's intermittent, but fairly dependably intermittent pleasure and surprise, sentence by sentence, sometimes word by word, sometimes syllable by syllable, say in the assonance of some of the sentences of Joyce's Araby. You know, it's almost impossible to ignore that Araby, which is a story and well told, despite what many of its early readers felt about it, is constantly pleasurable. So maybe I shouldn't say constantly. I should back off from that a little bit. But some of those sentences, the sentences that about the play of the boys. And there's one that climaxes, as I recall, on the description of going into the dark, odorous stables where the groom shook music from the buckled harness. And I cannot read those sentences without knowing that they are in language. At the same time, that it seems to me, in a very impassioned way, they create for me a narrator telling a story. I don't believe that this story literally happened, say, to the young James Joyce, though something like it sort of happened, I guess. He did live on North Richmond Street and so on. Am I getting anywhere, Daryl? Somehow the story well told, we do know it is in language, and yet it is not only language, it is a story. There is this sense of human agency and movement and passion, feeling. That may be what Helen, I think, was saying, something about combining the language with the story. Combining is almost too weak a word there. It is somehow finding the story in the language or making the story in the language so well. Yeah, okay, the word rendering, we could come back to that. Yeah, we certainly could. I find no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones, I'm thinking. You know, that's Whitman, and I don't know how that applies here. Let's get our next question, please.
Oh. I don't want it to be softened in any way. It seems to be that it's being suggested that I'm saying that the well-written story is well-written in language, too, and that's not. I'm saying that's wonderful. I have nothing against story, but I'm also saying that at one point the language needs to break down. It needs to somehow become opaque. An Amy Hempel story. Lee has been dead 9 years, semicolon. She can't stop talking about it. Okay? It's not a story about heaven. It's not a story about hell. It's not a science fiction story. It's a straightforward story about some women who get together one afternoon. And there's this wonderful sentence in there that depends on the semicolon, and it breaks down there. There are thousands and thousands of ways that it can be done, but I'm not saying it's been said for hundreds of years, you know, the correlation between content and form must be beautiful and aesthetically pleasing. I'm saying that at one point the language, or somewhere, not just one point, but the language does need to break down, for me, in a story.
If it's okay, I'd like to move a little bit away from language and ask a question about how goes the Mormon short story. I came to reading short stories by reading Eudora Welty and Mansfield and Isaac Singer, a lot of people for a lot of years, and particularly found that I liked Isaac Singer because he wrote about a way of life that I thought I find as completely a way of life as Mormonism is. And I found that his stories, although about very Jewish things, I related to very much. And I wonder about how much acceptance there is for stories that are written from the Mormon culture and how widely these stories are getting exposure through national publishers as well as national press.
I should have asked you to tell us your name. Do you want to do that? Say it. Bonnie? Thank you. My little anecdote about greening wheat would be a kind of indicator. I mean, I did find it interesting and a little perplexing that in Don Marshall's hometown, some readers, a handful of readers, had not found his story, Lavender Blue, quite communicating with it. I mean, the story is set in Tremonton, but that shouldn't worry one too much. Because one likes to think that even in the 20th century, when art has somehow, or literature has somehow become rather separated from communal life or sequestered within communal life or something, I don't know how to describe it, that still a storyteller and his or her community would be somehow connected. I wouldn't want to generalize about Don Marshall's relation to the readers of Panguitch from that one instance, but it is a somewhat troubling instance. I don't know really how to answer the full range of your question. I wanted to suggest a couple of things. I think there is within the Mormon community an occasion like this is some evidence of it, a connection between story writers and an audience. It happens, but out beyond, I don't know. Well, Daryl doesn't write very explicitly about Mormon people or Mormon communities or anything like that very often, but he does publish widely. Helen publishes widely. I mean, Roses of Eden did appear in, what was that, Harper's? And a man in Texas wanted to marry the heir. Judith Freeman's book, which includes a handful of stories using her Mormon background, her collection Family Attractions, was published nationally. It's happening slowly. I think there may be this sort of odd disjunction, though. How much of the Mormon audience outside of, say, the relatively small membership of AML knows that there are those stories in Judith Freeman's book? Or that Walter Kern's book, My Hard Bargain, contains some pretty interesting stories that use Mormon subjects, including a beautifully lyric story about a family being a troubled and fragmented family being converted by missionaries and getting baptized. I don't know. I mean, I'm aware of only a small audience of Mormon readers that knows that story of Walter Kern's. It's a collection. Yeah, and not all of them deal with Mormon subjects, and some that seem to me to be very Mormon in certain ways. The characters are not explicitly Mormon or anything. There's always the getting together of a writer, a storyteller, a story writer, story maker, and his or her audience is always, I think, a very chancy thing. The way in which most story writers that I've ever met have responded to meeting a reader who likes their work is, I think, evidence of that. And that's they welcome it. It's here's one reader who really paid attention, and it's gratifying to a reader to know that attention is valued. Frederick Bush, who's a very good sort of secular Jewish writer, thanked me in an inscription on one of his books for what did he call it? Something inscribed it, whose hard attention and something I look forward to. I was glad. Obviously, he was glad that I read him and wanted at times to talk about it. But I think Mormon writers face the same difficulty as any writers. I don't know. I'm trailing off, not with a bang, but a whimper. Let's see what someone else may want to do to respond to that.
I was just thinking that when I first started publishing a lot about 7 or 8 years ago, my stories aren't really 100% Mormon stories like Don Marshall or somebody, but a lot of them do have references to Mormonism. And I encountered some opposition from that in national magazines. People would say, well, I really like this, but I don't get the Mormon stuff. And could you make it a little, could you explain it more? And then I didn't want to do that because I thought it took away from it. And so what I did, to tell you the truth, is I turned them into Catholic stories because everybody understood those references. And so most people thought I was a Catholic. And I got away with that. I wouldn't do that anymore because I don't think it's necessary. But I have noticed in the national magazines now that this tends to be kind of a trend to mention Mormons in an offhanded way. I guess people have discovered Mormons from all the PR efforts of the church and so on. They know them now. They know who the missionaries are. They've seen them. They might not know any doctrinal things, but they're certainly aware of the presence of Mormonism as a what they usually think of as kind of a kooky religion. But this story that I had in Harper's, which was published 6 years ago, mentions Mormonism throughout. It's about a woman whose mother has joined the church, and she's trying to get the narrator, who's a widow, to join the church by telling her that she can be with her husband forever, not realizing that the woman really wasn't that thrilled with her husband in the first place. And so that's no incentive. But I have found that now I get greater acceptance for stories that mention Mormonism. And in fact, in the past month, there was a story in the New Yorker that was a very straightforward story, and in no way was it a Mormon story, except that there was one very minor character, and it was the narrator's brother-in-law. He said, my brother-in-law works at one of those software companies in Provo, and he just joined the Mormon church. Just said that right up front in the story. Never again did this guy come back as a character. I thought he was going to become some major character because he went into so much detail about his background. He didn't pop up again until near the end of the story, and he was just an incidental character. I thought that was really interesting. And so I think references to Mormonism are becoming pretty much the norm. I've found that, when you're submitting individual stories around the country, regionalism is really alive and well. And my old lady story was published in Florida. When I thought of that, I thought, well, yes, there are a lot of older people in Florida. I guess that intrigued them. And I've noticed that the middle or the Midwest, where the Mormons have a strong history, Illinois and those states, really like to, they like stories with a Mormon flair. I think University of Philadelphia is the one that published Levi Peterson's Canyons of Grace. And I've noticed that they're really open to that type of thing, just because a lot of people there are acquainted with Mormonism and are interested in it.
We've got at least one other writer of such stories in the audience, Karen Rosenbaum. I don't know if you want to respond to this, Karen, or not. I should have mentioned, I don't know what the publication date for this is. This fall, Signature Books, I believe, is going to publish an anthology, sizable anthology of short stories by Mormon writers, including probably everybody here. Are you all in that? You're not? Oh, we better do something about it. well, if they missed hell and they've Doggone it. Well, anyway, Gene England has been editing this, and if he's gone and missed, tell him he's made a mistake. The title is supposed to be Bright Angels and Familiars, unless someone is changing that. That's, I don't know how soon that's supposed to be out. I've been reading proof on my story that's in it. Okay. November. It sounds like, but as with Greening Wheat left out a whole lot of people I could have thought of to put in. It was space limitations. They're making, I think, a little more room in this one, but not enough room yet. We better do something about it. But there are a lot of writers writing and publishing. It was thanks to a neighbor. I don't know how many stories Helen was publishing, and this illustrates the problem even for a fairly alert and even industrious Mormon reader, which I think I am some of the time. I had no idea how many stories Helen had been publishing. Well, this was a few years ago, but a friend or neighbor of hers sent me a bunch of them. Said, I thought you should know about these. This was when I was awards chairman for the AML, and we did try to keep track of things like that. But one of the problems is that if Mormon writers publish outside the Mormon circuit, as many of them are now doing, people in the Mormon circuit don't know about it. Not really. The only thing is that the AML tries to keep track. We do the best we can, but we depend on friends and neighbors to keep us posted. We still have about 5 or 6 minutes, so yes, welcome. Let's have another question.
I hope it isn't unethical for me to advertise for my own session coming up tomorrow morning at 8:45, session 141. I'm going to be talking about responsible modes of Mormon aesthetic reception, and it ties in with some of the issues that we've just talked about today. I wonder if the writers here consciously think about a Mormon audience, either trying to ignore it or address it as they're composing their stories. The fact of the matter is that the Mormon market is very narrow and limited, and part of the problem is that we don't have a culture that will accommodate a lot of literature. We're not a literature appreciating culture by and large, which is disappointing. Compare, for example, the Jewish culture. Chaim Potok can rise to great heights, and as well as others like Singer and so on, because they have a literate church body that values literature for its own sake. One of the telling instances of this is I went into Deseret Book recently and was trying to find a copy of Milton to give to a friend, and they had no Milton whatsoever in Deseret Book. In fact, I had them call up on their computer, and they'd never sold any Milton. And I think that's a telling example. How can people appreciate contemporary fiction if they have never even been appreciating classic literature? And so if any of this is a question that I might address to the writers, do you consciously try to address a Mormon audience? Do you consciously try to avoid a Mormon audience?
That was Gideon Burton, who's giving a paper tomorrow on that kind of question. Well, since I'm standing up, although I have written a good deal less than any of these people here, I guess my answer would be to the question, do I think about a Mormon audience? In one way, not much, and in another way, maybe a lot. But I don't know if I want to try to go on and specify what I mean by that. But not much, simply that I find trying to write a story absorbs so much of my energy and attention when I'm doing it that I don't have time to think about an audience. I'm thinking very hard about, well, alas, language, about sentences and semicolons and how to get the comma just right and so forth. But I think maybe in some sort of surrounding ambience to that activity, I probably am thinking about will this be intelligible to, say, Mormon readers. I think much about will it uplift them or offend them. I already know that. Yes, you know, on both. or maybe yes on one and no on the other. No, it won't uplift them. Yes, it probably will offend them. I don't know. I've been gratified to discover that there are plenty of readers out there who aren't Mormon, who know enough about Mormon to understand references to things that I think of as fairly deeply embedded in Mormon culture. And so so what if a lot of readers don't? If John Hawks actually can understand a story I've written from, I think, pretty far within Mormon culture, then I probably shouldn't worry too much about readers outside. That would be sort of one of my, a kind of half-baked answer for me to that question. Would the rest of you respond even briefly, please?
The only time I think about audience is when I go to send it out. When I write, it cannot be part of it. It's like, well, I got this quilt, might as well use it. Even if I'm thinking about audience, who I'm going to have to impress, my grandmother who makes quilts. I mean, if I think about that, it destroys all my creativity. I can't write a word. And so I try not to think about audience. I write to an imaginary person that's just like me, you know, or something. But many me's or something that can understand my illusions or whatever. And if they don't, then they can't read it, maybe. But then when I come to send it out, I go, no, that audience isn't going to like that, you know. But I don't let it affect what I'm writing at the time.
I agree. I don't ever think about the audience while I'm writing. And if you do, it's a form of self-censorship. If you're thinking, who's going to read this and what will they think of it? Will my mother think this is pornographic? Or, you know, will my bishop call me in for an interview if he reads this? You'll never get anywhere if you do that. And I do agree with Pauline, though, that at the time of submission, that's the time to think about your audience and who is going to go for it, because if no one reads it, what's the use? Although Cheryl will have a fit, but I said that. Anyway, I suppose art for art's sake is definitely crucial, but we all want to be read, don't we? So you do have to think about who your potential audience is when you're putting the story in the envelope, but certainly not during the composition period.
I don't know if I need to add anything. I don't think about audience either, except maybe for somebody who's interested in writing stories, I do keep in mind two people. And all I think is, will they think this is a clunker when I write a sentence? And one is my wife, who is a very good writer and artist, and the other is Francois Camoin. And so that's the only audience I have in mind, and will they think this is a clunker? That's it.
If my watch, which is 3 minutes fast, is actually 3 minutes fast, our time is up. Thank you for coming, and I wish to thank again the panelists for coming and preparing to speak on this topic. That's it then.